From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Naomi Starkman became a food journalist because she noticed something missing in the way stories about food were being reported. What was missing was a connection between food and, well, pretty much everything else. Food, Starkman says, is connected to the health of the environment. It's connected to immigration and labor and energy. But not only that, she says it's connected to culture, to gender roles, to childcare and education. Naomi Starkman is in Utah this week to talk about her work documenting these connections in the good food movement. She'll join us today to discuss her transition from lawyer to farmer to activist. Naomi Starkman today, after the news.
Hey, it's Tim Slover from KUER. You like podcasts, right? I do. So this month, we're asking you to tell someone about a podcast you think they'll love. That could be your mom or a friend or, I don't know, someone who doesn't really get podcasts yet, anybody. You can pick whatever podcast you want. Maybe it's about music or politics, maybe cooking or Stranger Things fan theories or rodeo clowning or meditation. Just get a friend to listen. Remember to hit the share button and use the hashtag tripod. That's try with a Y followed by pod because of jokes. And thanks for getting the word out.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. A few months ago, the journalist Naomi Starkman wrote a piece for Civil Eats. It's the food website she began in 2009. In the article, she says, technology in agriculture is hot these days, $4.6 billion in investments last year. Some of that money went for plant-based meat, for example. There are a few of those. And one company makes eggless mayonnaise. There's a $700 juicer that's getting a lot of attention these days, a meal replacement drink called Soylent. That last one makes you wonder, why do we need something to replace a meal? It's a good question. Starkman says in the article, all of these investments in biotech and farming sensors and drones and data got her wondering, where is the capital for investing in real farms and real people who do the farming? The question gets at the essence of the work she's been doing over the last few years, documenting the rise of the good food movement. Naomi Starkman is coming to Utah this week, and today in the program she's joining us to discuss the growth and this new interest in the real food economy. Naomi Starkman is a founder and the editor-in-chief of the daily news publication CivilEats.com. It won the 2014 James Beard Award for Publication of the Year. The writer Michael Pollan has called Naomi Starkman one of the most influential people in the food movement. She's previously worked as a media consultant at The New Yorker, Vanity Fair, Wired magazine, and others. She's in Salt Lake City this week giving a lecture at later today at the Utah Museum of Natural History. We'll give you details about that as we go along. She's joining us today from the studios of NPR member station KQED in San Francisco. Naomi Starkman, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Doug. It's a great pleasure to talk with you today.
I want to start with your connection to food. When did that begin for you? I know you had an epiphany later in life in New York, I think it was, and we'll talk about that later. But did you have a connection to food before that? You know, ideas about food before that.
Like most people, I think I grew up appreciating food and seeing how food could connect us in such beautiful ways. In many ways, food can really be love. We break bread together. We share our triumphs and our sorrows over food. We have this amazing human connection to, and cultural connection to food. And so I think just by sheer virtue of eating, I was aware of the power of food, but it took a couple years to start connecting dots to how food really is such a big part of everything we do, from the environment to public health to our social and cultural fabric.
When did the connection really first occur to you that, wait, these are all related in some way?
Right. Well, you know, oddly, I did grow up in the Bay Area, but I spent about 5 years working in media, mainstream media, in New York City. And it was there, strangely enough, that I had this realization that, in fact, this deep connection, that food was sort of at the center of all of these parts of our society. It touches everything we do. It's a business story. It's a cultural story. It's an international story. And that's really when I had this awakening. I was working at the New Yorker magazine at the time, and we had this really incredible 3-day festival. It still happens. And I was lucky enough to participate in a dinner with a number of very well-known chefs, and they had this table there, and it was laden high with beautiful food. And this light bulb went on for me, and I started wondering, what is the story behind this food? And it wasn't just, you know, how the food tasted. It was also just the story I wanted to know. I wanted to know more about its journey from farm to fork, and I realized there was so much to know. And I also realized while I was having this awakening that it wasn't just me, that there was a whole country awakening to the conversation around food.
And so you had this moment of realization, but then what did you figure you wanted to do with it? Because that's the trick, right?
Right, of course. You know, I was very lucky to have been at this event with some very wonderful chefs. Chefs have always been incredibly informative to me along my path. One in particular is Alice Waters, Chef Alice Waters from legendary Chez Panisse. And I had not met Alice, even though I grew up in the Bay Area, and she was at this dinner at the New Yorker, and she started talking to me about agroecology. And she told me you can go work on an organic farm anywhere in the world through a really amazing program called Worldwide Opportunities on Organic Farms. The acronym is WOOF.
Yeah.
And I was a freelancer at the time. And a few months later, sure enough, I was woofing in Costa Rica and Nicaragua. And I farmed at all these incredible organic farms in Central America. And while I was there, I had a really incredible coincidence, some might say kismet or serendipitous adventure, where I met an organic farmer on a boat between Costa Rica and Nicaragua. I was headed to go farm at a coffee farm in Nicaragua on the island of Ometepe. And there was one other gringa on the boat with me, and she sat in front of me, and she turned around and she said, "What are you doing on this boat?" And I said, "I'm going to this farm. What are you doing?" And she said, "So am I. I'm on vacation. I'm an organic farmer." And she became a huge force in my life, a touchstone. And she really shaped what my life became thereafter. She told me that if I wanted to really become a farmer, I needed to consider thinking about farming more than just as a woofer. And I did. And when I got back to New York, I started farming part-time.
Well, give me a sense of what else you learned from her. I mean, what did she mean that you had to, you can't just talk the game. You have to learn to do it. That's going to be critical to your education.
I think so. Yeah. So much of what we do. I mean, I think as a culture, we're highly overeducated and underexperienced. I know that was true for myself. You mentioned I had studied law. I had worked in policy. And then I realized that mainstream media seemed so much more efficient in terms of getting our message across. You know, I'm also really somebody who's quite impatient, and I just felt like news was quicker. And so that's where I was at that moment in my life. But her point was, you can't really know whether you want to do something without doing it. And by putting my hands in the soil and trying it, became one of the most deeply rooted experiences of my life. Now, don't forget, I was working in a high-rise building in the middle of Times Square. I mean, probably the opposite experience of what would feel rooted, right? And here I was having this opportunity where when I got back to New York, Dan Barber, Chef Dan Barber of famed restaurant Blue Hill and Stone Barns outside of Manhattan had just opened the farm, and I would put my bike on the train at 125th Street in Harlem, take the train out to Tarrytown where the farm is, ride it for about a mile to the farm, and the other couple days of the week I'd be in the office at the New Yorker. And it was just this really kind of crazy sometimes felt schizophrenic life, but one fed the other. One opportunity allowed me to see into a window of what the world might be. It gave me the opportunity to see whether, in fact, I could be a farmer. And I learned so much that year. And in fact, I decided to quit the New Yorker and become a farmer full time.
How did David Remnick react to that? You've talked about this, that he was like, he thought, okay, seriously, this might be a mistake.
Well, he's a smart guy, no doubt. And, you know, and definitely an East Coaster through and through. And I said, you know, I'm going to be leaving and I'm going to go farm. And he said, are you crazy? What are you doing? And he said, that's just really so crazy. And I thought, yeah, you know, I said to him, it is. And I promise you, these stories are going to matter. Food and agriculture is going to matter. And it does. And I just had that foresight. And I'm so glad I did.
You've called farming a faith-based career. What do you mean by that? And the idea of it being uncontrollable. I guess that's part of the charm. Maybe charm is not quite the way, but maybe that's part of the draw, I guess. Would you talk about that?
Sure. Well, first of all, I have never done anything harder in my life than farm. I have incredible respect for the farm workers in this country. I really stand at their feet. They are my true heroes. It is literally back-breaking work. And I call it faith-based because it's one of those things where you put seeds in the ground and you hope they grow. Yeah. And there are so many things we can't control. I mean, you can have beautiful crops that you plant that then get washed away due to weather or insects or any number of things. And the kinds of risks that farmers take, it's really unprecedented. And yet we live in a culture that's so disconnected mm-hmm. from how food is actually grown that we don't understand. So, for example, the first day that I farmed in Washington State was Earth Day, and we planted something like 75,000 leeks. Now, baby leeks are like a blade of grass, mm-hmm. and we had to separate them and plant them, and then thinking about tilling them and hoeing them, and this is an organic farm I worked on. The process of caring for these leeks over an entire season, it was so incredibly eye-opening to me because we don't consider a leek or an onion a particularly important part of our lives. We take them for granted. We throw them on our table, kitchen counters, and, you know, they're just sort of a part of the ingredients of a recipe. But through this process of growing and tending to these thousands of leeks and onions, I really understood what it meant. And I truly believe had I not done that work, I would not have what I now call my dirt cred, which is the sense of understanding what it takes to farm.
We had a conversation with a filmmaker who did a documentary about Wendell Berry a couple of weeks ago. And Berry said this really beautiful thing in I don't know if it was a poem or just a piece that he had written, that at the beginning of the season, a farmer offers or imagines their crop with the ideal of perfection. And then throughout the season, as it progresses, as it gets hit by drought or by insects or by whatever else, it becomes imperfect, but still at the end of the harvest season, it's an offering that you make. Like, this was the best I could do. You ever think about it in that sense?
Oh, I think that's so beautiful. I mean, Wendell Berry is one of my deepest heroes. And not only is he a celebrated writer and farmer and an elder statesman of local food, but he is one of the most genuine and generous people I've ever had the opportunity to meet. And the sense of community that he's talking about in that experience and the sense of love, not just for the land, but for the people who were involved in the process of growing food is so what transformed me. And I think is part of what's touching so many people in the country. There's this sense of disconnection, and that's all of its, you know, unintended consequences. but then the yearning for something that feels real and tangible and holy, and that sense of pulling from the earth that what you hoped for and then sharing it. And that's a very beautiful act.
It's interesting. How do you trace the beginnings of this movement? I mean, Michael Pollan wrote Omnivore's Dilemma. Has it been 10 years now?
It's 11.
11 years now. Mm-hmm. Was that a turning point? It seems like he really hit something because that book took off. It seemed to have really resonated with people in deep ways.
I think that's right. I mean, before Michael wrote that book, Eric Schlosser wrote Fast Food Nation.
Yeah.
And I think there were a couple of very important pieces of information that were coming to light for the public. I mean, one thing about Pollan's Omnivore Dilemma that's so important to know, and Michael has said this himself, is that the book did not really address food and farm workers.
Right.
It was more from the perspective of the eater than from the producer. And so one of the things that's really changed in the last decade or so around food is this growing awareness, not just how your food is grown, but who is growing it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this rising farm worker awareness that I think is so important. And it's one of the things I really want to talk to people about. It's one of the things we really do at Civil Eats, which is to not just write about recipes and reviews and the deliciousness of food, which mm-hmm. it is, but that there is a social component that we as eaters are participating in, that we are co-producers in this food system. And it's incumbent upon us to respect that relationship and support it in a way that's meaningful.
I want to come back to that point actually a little bit later, this idea of food justice. This is something that's really important to you. But I also wanted to ask you before that, what does farming do for us? Because you've written about farming as rehabilitation, how there are these studies that show just getting your hands in the dirt has some effect on our serotonin levels, on our mm-hmm. disposition.
It's true. I mean, I, had my own kind of self healing through working in the soil. And there are a number of studies that show how there's this incredible positive impact that living soil can have on the physiological level and other aspects of mental health. So I think one of the most amazing pieces of farming, it's not just that we can feed ourselves and be self-sustaining if we do it in a way that's holistic and protecting of the earth, but we can also build community. And this sense of rehabilitation is being seen in programs for former veterans and for individuals who were formerly incarcerated. There are all sorts of programs for youth, and I have personally seen how farming can transform individuals. It transformed me, and I've seen it many times with people who did not have skills or felt they did not have a future. There is this sense of pride and growing something. Mm. It's so real, and I think that is a beautiful side of agriculture. It's one of the things agriculture does for us.
Is it a biological connection? Is there some evolutionary component that makes it just seem like when we're in a field, planting something or harvesting something, that just really connects with us in a really deep way?
I would say so. I mean, there's been a number of studies and books on, biophilia, the sense of being in nature and what it does for us. Studies about simple things like going for a walk and being in a park or just seeing trees and what that can do on our mental state. I know for myself, I had such an incredible sense of almost euphoria standing in the fields in the morning, watching the sunflowers, which are heliotropic. They turn their heads with the sun, and just seeing the dew on the face of the flower with the honeybee still asleep, nestled in the flower. Just seeing that was, to me, otherworldly.
Naomi Starkman is with us, founder and editor-in-chief of the daily news publication CivilEats.com. We'll put a link to it on our website. Tonight at 7, she's giving a lecture about the good food movement at the Utah Museum of Natural History. This is a free event. You can reserve seats for it online We have links to all of that on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a quick break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about food. And we're talking about the good food movement, which is about local, organic, natural food, producing it in ways that benefit the land, but also benefit the people who grow it. The journalist Naomi Starkman has been on the forefront of this movement. She's coming to Utah this week. She's joining us today to talk about how food is more than just sustenance. It's nourishment, which she says feeds your body, but also your soul. She's going to be at the Utah Museum of Natural History tonight. We'll give you some more details about that a little bit later on the program. So I wanted to ask you about what are you expecting in the Trump administration in the way of agriculture, ag policy? I mean, this is a big focus for you. You've talked about how people think of it as a nonpartisan issue, but one thing you've said is that food is politics. It's also a fight for progressive values. Let's start there. How you see food in the political scheme.
Sure. Well, I actually think food has become quite politicized. Food is a $1 trillion industry. It touches many aspects of our policy and business world in the United States. Like most things right now, food policy is in flux, and President Trump hasn't said much about the topic directly. He has indicated some interest in particular aspects of it with respect to he took a private meeting, for example, with executives from two big agrochemical companies, Bayer and Monsanto. Yeah. There's a merger between them right now, so there's a pending merger, and so that was pretty unusual that he did that. He also appointed, nominated, his Secretary of Agriculture, Sonny Perdue, as his last cabinet member. So there's been a lot of heads wagging, especially in rural America, where a lot of Trump supporters live and who are concerned. He also takes a particular position on trade, which has been in conflict with a lot of farming communities. So we haven't seen much yet. I mean, the big question for agriculture in the United States is immigration. Yeah. And Trump made immigration a central part of his campaign. It's a huge part of his administration. And that is changing day to day. There's been a lot of... Right. So I think what we're seeing is sort of trying to understand, read the tea leaves where we can understand, for example, the new head of EPA, Scott Pruitt, what policies he might roll back. We're seeing a slash of the budget at EPA. So being in the position I'm in right now is, like many people feel in the United States, a little bit of whiplash in terms of news and things changing every day. We just don't know. Yeah. A lot of it is uncertain. And that's challenging to report on, but we are trying to keep our eyes on the larger issue, on issues that we know impact everybody and will continue to impact people.
What do you make of the his nominee for Agriculture Secretary? This is Sonny Perdue, former governor of Georgia, once ran a grain and fertilizer business. He was described in the media as an immigration hawk who once led lawmakers in a prayer for rain during a drought. What do you, I guess, again, I won't ask you to speculate, but what do you make of this choice?
Well, in some ways, Sonny Perdue pleased a lot of central right folks in the United States, especially in politics. He certainly is somebody who knows agriculture. It's important that, you know, he's the son of a Georgia farmer. He's a veterinarian by training. USDA operates a budget of more than $140 billion, and it has more than 100,000 people in its staff. So I think there was a sense that they needed somebody in place who understood policy, somebody who understood agriculture. USDA oversees not just food and agriculture, but also natural resources and things like nutrition and rural development. So I think the pick was important in terms of his experience. Now, there are a number of advocates who are very concerned about his, what they would call, coziness with big ag, mm-hmm. his relationship to concentrated animal feeding operations, otherwise known as factory farming, and yes, his kind of sense of folksy, whimsical sense of praying for rain. Some folks have said he's a climate denier. So I'll say, from what I'm hearing from advocates and activists, there's a lot of concern about what will happen to USDA under Sonny Perdue.
I want to come back to something we had briefly talked a little bit before. You've said that you think agriculture is uncontrollable in many ways, but there's, in the system we have, there's this impulse to try and control it. Are you seeing that in people like Sonny Perdue, and maybe some of those folksy thinking is, you know, pesticides maybe before other things? I mean, what are you seeing that way?
It's an interesting question. I think part of what has happened in the last, four decades or so has been an attempt to control agriculture in the United States by creating a farm bill, which is this arcane piece of legislation that gets re-upped every 5 years that really oversees almost every aspect of what we eat. Farm bill would be a great way to look at how we try to control our food supply, and we don't do it very well. It is challenging to think about how we have so many different parts and pieces regulating food. And there's been a call by some thinkers, including Michael Pollan and Mark Bittman, Ricardo Salvador, and others, to have one food policy department for the United States. We have all these different departments. We have USDA, we have the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, we have the EPA. And they all oversee different pieces and parts to food. Pesticides, as you mentioned, are one piece of controlling agriculture. Mm-hmm. As we know now, the application of pesticides has been sort of what's been called a treadmill situation. They were first kind of brought out with the hope or prayer that they would solve some of the real challenges of growing food by controlling the natural environment. And instead, what's happened is we've had some pretty serious health implications from pesticides in the United States, including not just on farm workers, but on communities that live around those farms and then downstream. But we also have a situation in which we have to use more pesticides, and the pesticides that we have used are now experiencing like a pesticide resistance, almost like an antibiotic resistance that we've seen in overuse of antibiotics and industrial animal livestock.
You outlined a national food policy. This was, I think, 2 years ago. What are the obstacles to getting a systemic, holistic approach even considered? What are you thinking of the challenges are about that now?
Oh, goodness. It's incredibly challenging now. It is probably more challenging now than ever. I think a couple years ago, there was this call for this national food policy, and we've seen some gains on the political front, things like soda tax being passed in a number of states. We've seen the increase in minimum wage in some states. So we see these pieces and parts in regional areas or at the statewide level. The national reality right now is so completely uncertain, frankly. I'm not sure whether we'll have a national food policy anytime soon.
It's interesting. So you've got your sense of not pessimism, but you're really worried about where things are. Yet on the other hand, there's this, it seems like this younger generation, millennials and younger, who have really taken hold of this movement. And it seems like they're driving the interest. They're helping connect you know, farming and food to the larger social issues like hunger and poverty and climate change. So I guess there are reasons to be optimistic, as well as reasons to be pessimistic, I suppose.
That's right. I mean, I always joke I'm a short-term pessimist, but a long-term optimist. Mm-hmm. And I don't think you could do this work if you weren't. You know, I think your point is so important about young people. Everywhere I go in this country, I meet young people for whom food is their movement, very much like the environmental movement was the movement of the 70s and 80s in which I was raised. And food is touching them in such a deep way, and I'm seeing them having this awakening that I had myself, the sense of, gosh, just wanting something that feels real. And they are not just going back to the land, and they're not just interested in agroecology. They are moving the marketplace in ways that are pretty phenomenal. In the United States in particular, we've seen young people shoring up businesses and moving companies much more quickly than regulations on issues like antibiotics in meat and scaling up cage-free eggs and demanding food that's less processed and with fewer artificial ingredients. And last year, this incredible growth hit a $43 billion benchmark for the organic food industry. And at the same time, the top 25 food and beverage companies in the United States lost a combined market share of something like $18 billion since 2009. So we're seeing this, at least in the marketplace, this incredible sense of change and demand for more truth, trust, and transparency in our food system. And that is not going away. I mean, the reformulating of brands, something as simple as Kraft macaroni and cheese, which has been reformulated so that the cheese is no longer artificial or has artificial coloring added to it. That is all a result of young people in particular asking for more information, and the market is responding to that.
What is it about these young people that is making them interested in food, do you think? I mean, you got at it a little bit, but you say they want something real. Is it a response to digital technology that might not be as satisfying, or are there multiple factors going into play?
I think there are a few factors. I mean, interestingly, I was at Stanford last year as a Knight Fellow, which is a program for journalists, and I spent a great deal of time doing research in the design school with the Feed Collaborative, which is a program that looks at how the food system works. And we started looking at my core reader, who is a millennial, self-described food-focused millennial. And we started really digging in to ask these questions you're asking. And one of the things we discovered was that millennials in particular, unfortunately for them, are growing up with an incredible amount of anxiety. They, more than any generation, have such a sense of environmental uncertainty and economic uncertainty. And for them, food is comforting and it feels connecting and they can control it. There's a wonderful book by a great writer. Her name is Eve Thoreau. It's called Generation Yum. And it's all about this notion that millennials are so connected to food. They feel a sense of control of the few things they can control in their current life. Food is one of them. So there's this sense of, you know, you always see millennials, or you read perhaps about millennials taking Instagram photos of food. Part of that, she wrote, or has at least researched and understands to believe, a way of control. So there's a technological piece to it. There's a piece of my reality feels really out of control, and I'm going to use food as a way to control it. But to your earlier point of a sense of natural connection, I think it's just there. Young people are also really about authenticity. And one of the reasons why I think our news site has succeeded in that with that generation is because of our authenticity. We don't take advertising, for example, and that's been a big response from our readers that we're an independent news site. That's really important to young people. They don't actually trust labels. So, for example, they don't trust the USDA organic label, which for many is considered the gold standard. So there's all these competing tensions around food as a control factor, as a way to make decisions, as a way to make community. There's a lot of sharing around food, and there's a peer-to-peer food sharing component to this as well. I mean, it's really fascinating.
It's interesting. The way you're, everyone's freaked out about how you monetize the web and how you monetize these journalistic mm-hmm. ventures. You've tried a couple of things. A paywall is one thing. It sounds like it's working in the sense that people are willing to pay for content if they trust it, I guess.
I think that's right. I mean, part of what we're seeing, there's a lot of research that shows that young people don't want to pay for journalism. They just didn't grow up with that standard or model. And so it's part of why journalism is definitely under stress, because of the digital model. There just isn't a business model for digital journalism. And then there are studies that show that young people don't want to actually pay for news, but if they feel that they are part of a community, which I know our readers do, they are willing to pay. We have, as you mentioned, a subscription service that's $25 a year. And I, in the beginning, would write handwritten thank you notes to our readers from all across the country. But the feedback I got from it was so valuable, because what I was hearing was thank you for doing this. And so there was almost this quality of being part of something in addition to helping us support independent news. And again, if there's any silver lining in these very turbulent times, one in particular is that people finally understand the importance of an independent press and how important it is to have watchdogs holding the powerful accountable. That is so critical, in addition to the fact that I'm seeing so many people engaged for the first time, really civically active, and that's wonderful.
Naomi Starkman is with us, founder and editor-in-chief of the daily news publication CivilEats.com. There's a link to that on our website. Tonight at 7, she's giving a lecture about the food movement at the Utah Museum of Natural History. It's free. You can reserve seats for it online. We have links to all of that on our website, RadioWest.org. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us Naomi Starkman, founder and editor-in-chief of the daily news publication CivilEats.com. She's giving a lecture at the Utah Museum of Natural History tonight. We have links to that, by the way, on our website if you need details. It's free. You can reserve seats for it online. She's talking about the good food movement, and she's joining us to talk about it today. I wanted to come back to this. I mentioned this earlier in an introduction, this article that you wrote last summer, where you raised this question about the tech industry and the attention they're paying to agriculture. But the products that these venture capitalists are investing in, like I mentioned, eggless mayonnaise, Soylent, this meal replacement drink, this really crazy expensive juicer, what is it called? Juicero or whatever?
Juicero,
mm-hmm. Yeah. What is that about? And because you seem mystified, like a lot of us might be, of why they're not investing in actual food. I mean, is it just this an inclination of Silicon Valley to go for these odd little startups?
Such a great question. And as I mentioned, I was at Stanford last year. And so part of my secret, not so secret mission was to try to talk to a lot of venture capitalists and really understand what was happening for them around food. As you mentioned earlier, there's been this tremendous investment in technology and food. And I went to so many topical conversations and meetups around ag tech, and I just kept scratching my head and wondering, first, had any of them ever farmed or been on a farm? And second, you know, I kept wondering, you know, this notion of moving fast and breaking things, which is that famous slogan that Facebook's founder Mark Zuckerberg has always said in terms of what you do in the Silicon Valley. I was kept leaving these events wondering, is that really the right solution for food? Food is a fungible, you know, perishable good. It doesn't scale like software. And, you know, food has become in some ways very sexy in the tech world. And yet I kept feeling like a conversation was not happening or being missed around what was actually needed, as if we needed farmers at the table yet again to really say, well, this would be helpful to me as a farmer. Actually, that drone wouldn't be helpful. Or one of the interesting pieces to this conversation is that a lot of the technology that's being developed is actually proprietary to large companies, including Monsanto, that then the farmer doesn't actually have access to. So it's complicated. And it's also challenging. It's challenging to be in the space. And we're not just talking about meal replacement or eggless mayonnaise. We're talking about meal delivery and apps and all sorts of technology to help try to guide and shape. And obviously for venture capitalists, make money off of this increasing interest in food.
You ask in the article, what would it take for investing in food and ag to become as hot as apps and drones? What would it take? What would it take for people to start making that connection? Do you know?
Well, I really love that someone like Steve Case, the chairman and CEO of AOL, and now at Revolution, which is a VC firm, a venture capital firm, he said, he wrote this great piece, and he said, you know, I've seen the future of food, and with all due respect to my colleagues in the Silicon Valley, it is not Soylent. I think he said something like, it's not Schmoylent or Schmilk or something, right? He really says it's the future of food is food. And I think for those VCs who are understanding agriculture, growing food, what it looks like, I mean, I'll tell you, if I had a magic wand, what I would love to see, and it's, again, completely unsexy, but what we really need in the United States is deep investment in regional food hubs, and those are distribution centers that help scale up small to medium-sized farmers and bring their wares to consumers that are demanding them. We simply cannot meet the demand for organic food, and so those totally nerdy, wonky things like distribution, transportation, refrigeration. That is where we need investment to help farmers get their food to the people who would like to buy it.
Is there a cultural obstacle going on here? One of the things you've written about is the idea that this movement is seen as elitist. Like it's, you know, people wandering in and out of farmers markets, and they have the affluence to be able to do it, to be able to spend the money for that, or in and out of Whole Foods or whatever it might be. How do you react to that?
It's really important to address, and I'm glad you raised it, because what's happened in this, you know, rising awareness around food is this notion that first, food has emerged as a cultural and economic counterforce to industrialized agriculture, which is important. But this criticism that good food is elitist and only accessible to those who can afford it is real. And for a long time, the conversation just has not been inclusive. It hasn't been about equity or access or justice. And so trying to talk about the true cost of food. Why is it that we pay so little for food in the United States? What are the inherent costs when we look at an industrial agricultural system that we as a society are paying for? Trying to flesh out some of that conversation, I think, is incredibly important to understand and also help make good food available for all. I truly believe that good food is not just a privilege, it's a right, and we need to make it part of every community in the United States.
7 of the 10 lowest paying jobs in this country, you've pointed out, are in food.
Mm-hmm. And as a result, we are looking at people who are living without a living wage. One of the great successes, I would say, in the last several years has come from a group of people working to raise the minimum wage. I'll be talking a little bit about that tonight, but the Restaurant Opportunities Center United has been incredible, along with the Food Workers Alliance, to try to raise the minimum wage in the Fight for 15, and they've really radicalized and politicized food workers across the country in order to win fair wages and better working conditions for restaurant workers.
How do you change the paradigm? This is another question you've asked. Can we do it? It seems like you have to get at our priorities as a people. And this has maybe goes to values, it seems like.
I could not agree more, Doug. I think it's all about our values. If we're willing to live in a society that values human beings, then we should be willing to pay more money for food and for all of its attendant inherent qualities. It is a value, and we have our values are not always aligned in this country, not always shared with everybody. The hope is that as time goes on, people will continue to look for opportunities to support this alternative paradigm, and that the alternative paradigm becomes the norm. It's a slow process. Many people question whether there is, in fact, even a so-called good food movement. It's totally incoherent. Its leadership is questionable. It's a sense of, you know, what is this movement? Is it just a marketplace movement? Is it a political movement? But I think there are some folks who study social movements who say that that is the very definition of being in the middle of a movement. It's this place that's really sticky and uncomfortable and uncertain, and yet we're seeing it, and we can't deny it. It's all around us. I feel so lucky to be able to document stories from across the United States, these stories of people in each community whom are real, you know, foot soldiers on the front lines of the food movement and who together are building these bright lights of a new food economy.
Seems like, I don't know, it seems like it's important that we talk about cooking, you know, together. I guess maybe even more importantly, a meal. I want to come back to the experience you had with Dan Barber. I think most of the people, you mentioned him, they'll have an idea of who he is. He is this extraordinary chef, co-owner of Blue Hill in New York, and what did you learn from him? One thing I've noticed in watching him work in documentaries that I've seen is he's pretty intense. It's an interesting contrast to what I imagine is the serenity of a farmer and the intensity of a chef. What did you learn from Dan Barber in that experience?
Well, first of all, I really care for Dan. He's a friend. I mean, he let me come farm at Stone Barns. Here was this kind of quirky media lady who would show up at his farm, you know, quite a bit older than the other farm interns. And he's such a great chef. Not only is Dan a great chef, he is a great author. And I just want to give a plug for his book, The Third Plate, because he really talks about this radical approach to food and farming in that book, starting with the soil. And so it's very unusual for a chef to really start talking about not just the provenance of the food that he is preparing, but even before that, how the food is grown. And that's such a cool thing about Stone Barns. Dan also is very innovative, and he's been doing quite a bit of work around food waste. So he's been doing these pop-ups called Wasted. I know he's going to be doing one in London. He did one in New York to really put have a real experience around all the food that we waste in the United States. To answer your question, Dan's food is otherworldly. Transformative. You taste the soil. You experience an incredible gastronomical event. That being said, not everybody will ever experience that. And so one of the great things about Dan's work is that you don't have to just eat at his restaurants to experience all that he is trying to do to transform the food system. I do want to say one thing, if I may, about cooking, and I'm so glad you raised that. I really believe, Doug, that cooking is a cornerstone of the sustainable food movement. And one of the interesting things, just to tie it back to what we were talking about before with young people, unfortunately, by and large, don't know how to cook. Now, part of that is just what happens when you're young. Mm-hmm. You don't know how to cook, but what's happening is this lack of connection to understanding how to prepare fresh fruits and vegetables. And my greatest hope is that we can kind of have a renaissance around food community centers, almost like YMCAs for food, to teach young people almost real home ec skills so that they can learn how to go to the farmer's market and prepare something for their friends and family.
Let me ask you finally, you mentioned when you got into journalism, one of the reasons you did was you had seen this gap in the way food was being covered. A lot of the food system was not being reported. Is that changing, do you think? And I mean, you've mentioned your website is now getting attention. People are paying for content. Are you seeing a shift in the way people are covering food these days?
Definitely. And I really commend my colleagues at many outlets that have now food verticals and aren't just covering food as deliciousness, but food as revolution. And it's exciting to see across mainstream media channels that there is a growing interest in these issues. And I think it will continue to grow for sure.
Naomi Starkman, founder and editor-in-chief of the daily news publication CivilEats.com. She's giving a lecture at the Utah Museum of Natural History. It's at 7 o'clock tonight. You can get details about it on our website, radiowest.org. She joined us today from the studios of radio station KQED in San Francisco. Naomi Starkman, thank you very much for the time.
Doug, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program directed today by Adrian Moranville. David Boyle is our intern. Radio West is produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.